So this is study number 9 in our camp meeting in Australia, South Australia 1992. Let us now turn back to the experience of Israel in their deliverance from Egypt. And this we want to study because it is object lesson, or a type I should say, for the last people's experience when they are delivered from the image of the beast. So we turn again to page 247 in Patriarchs and Prophets, where we read this about Moses. In slaying the Egyptian, Moses had fallen into the same error so often committed by his fathers of taking into their own hands the work that God had promised to do. It was not God's will to deliver his people by warfare, as Moses thought, but by his own mighty power, that the glory might be ascribed to him alone. So the point that we made in our study so far was that God never wants us to use the sword, and the sword we have seen being applicable in quite a range of circumstances. Now you may ask the question, to what does this apply? Does this apply if, for example, I have to get a pension, that I don't go to the state to ask for the pension? Would this be already going to the sword? And, you know, people are very sensitive in this respect, and there are some people who want nothing from any other person, and then in the end, the very extreme case would be you have to go in the cloister to live just by yourself. Now, of course, there must be some line, and it is not always easy to see the line. I think we have to learn in this respect, too. Now, definitely, when we have to fight for our rights, and in the fighting for our rights, we use the power of the state or the power of stronger people than we are, or the power of our muscles or whatever, instead the power of God, that is definitely using the sword. That is erecting the image of the beast. But when it is nothing, when it has nothing to do with fighting for our rights, but simply going an ordinary way that is very normal, we must not presume that this is erecting the image of the beast. I think we understand this, do we? Of course, you may ask me now, where is the line? Where do we begin to erect the image of the beast? Exactly. But I think it's difficult to define this like this. We must be taught day by day in this respect. And definitely, when we feel that we have to fight for our rights, that is an area where we should see that we rely on the power of God only. And here, when the image of the beast will be set up, our rights will be infringed upon. And then we need to learn to depend on the power of God. Now, I wonder a little bit, and what do you think about this? When the Sunday laws were coming around the turn of the centuries, A.D. Jones was doing a lot in terms of using the civil rights that he had. As a citizen, he went before the people of the Congress and presented before them the the dangers of Sunday laws and the injustice of it. He went, I think, even before Congress one time, did he? Yeah. And there presented his request. And you could say, well, was this okay? Was he really fighting for his rights? Or was this a thing that he should do according to his duties as a citizen? It is difficult to ascertain this always. A.D. Jones was a little bit of a fighter person, I find. And when you study through his history and his life, I would say there's not everything we could agree with. True, he was the messenger of God, but he made his mistakes, and his character was not perfect yet, by far not. Therefore, when I see some of his actions, I do not feel very comfortable with them. On the other hand, I do not feel quite at liberty to outright say everything was wrong. It might be that in the time when the Sunday laws will come up, that we have some duties in the civil lines to do, to warn the people against that. Definitely, we will have a message from God to warn the people against the image of the beast, but it will be by the power of the Holy Spirit that we will speak, and not by our own power. Nor will we depend on the powers of justice in order to avert that image of the beast, but we will depend only on the power of God. So with this little point, I just wanted to make sure that we do not go into extremes in this respect, but understand what it means to take the sword. It is wherever we take it instead of the power of God. But there are areas where God has given us powers that we must use. For example, when Jesus resurrected Lazarus, he could have removed the tombstone as well. But what did he say? He said, "You take away the stone, that is your work. You have the muscle power for it, so you do it." And it would be presumptuous then to say, "No, God's power must do it. I don't do it," wouldn't it? We must really understand that there's a cooperation between God and us. There's a part. Yeah. That's right. That is not the sword. The sword is, when we use the term the sword, we mean it in that context that it is the substitution for God's power, where God would exercise his power and where we substitute it with our own power. That is using the sword. In the context of the resurrection of Lazarus, we read in that Desire of Ages the following. Page, what was it again? Let's have a look. It's the chapter Lazarus Come Forth, 5-4 it starts. Page 535, we read, "When the Lord is about to do a work, Satan moves upon some object. 'Take away the stone,' Christ said. 'As far as possible, prepare the way for my work.'" Further down it says, "Take ye away the stone." Christ could have commanded the stone to remove, and it would have obeyed his voice. He could have bidden the angels who were close by his side to do this. At his bidding, invisible hands would have removed the stone, but it was to be taken away by human hands. Thus Christ would show that humanity is to cooperate with divinity. What human power can do, divine power is not summoned to do. God does not dispense with man's aid. He strengthens him, cooperating with him as he uses the powers and capabilities given him." Good. But now let's come back to Moses. And here we see definitely that he took into his hands the work that God had promised to do, and that is the typical taking of the sword. Again, let's read this. "In slaying the Egyptian, Moses had fallen into the same error so often committed by his fathers of taking into their own hands the work that God had promised to do. For example, God said, 'I am your shield.' Therefore, for them to take the shield would take the work that God had promised to do, and that is taking the sword. It was not God's will to deliver his people by warfare, as Moses thought, but by his own mighty power, that the glory might be ascribed to him alone." We will in our study see how God really worked in the deliverance of Egypt, and that is amazing what simple means he used. By this showing that the power that he uses is far superior to anything that man can invent, even the greatest inventions and powers that men use. Then it says, "Yet even this rash act was overruled by God to accomplish his purposes. Moses was not prepared for his great work. He had yet to learn the same lesson of faith that Abraham and Jacob had been taught, not to rely upon human strength or wisdom, but upon the power of God for the fulfillment of his promises. And there were other lessons that, amid the solitude of the mountains, Moses was to receive. In the school of self-denial and hardship, he was to learn patience, to temper his passions. Before he could govern wisely, he must be trained to obey. His own heart must be fully in harmony with God before he could teach the knowledge of his will to Israel. By his own experience, he must be prepared to exercise a fatherly care over all who needed his help." In other words, he needed to learn the spirit of service. The spirit of service, that is fatherly care. Fathers, they don't mind if their children are injustice at times towards them. They can take this because that are their children. If we are children or in the position of children, it's very difficult to take injustice, isn't it? Children tend to say, "Well, I expect at least justice from my parents and from the other adults, because I look up to them." But as a father, he can look over things, and he's only one object in mind, to do the best for his son, to educate him, to be him a blessing. That is his object, really. Not that he is hurt or not hurt or things like this, that is secondary. He wants the best for his children. And so Moses was to learn with the sheep that important lesson. Moses was done a great injustice when this Israelite accused him that he wanted to kill him like the Egyptian, wasn't it? He could have grumbled in his mind and said, these people, they are very ungrateful. I did everything for them. I did not consider the throne a real object to be desired in preference to my people. I rather went to my people. I helped them all the time. I showed that I was willing even to fight for them, and that is their gratitude. He could have grumbled all the time and could have said, I want nothing to do with that people anymore. But no, that was not his concern. He took into consideration that they were like children who had to learn, and they made a mistake. Okay, that mistake hit him, but that was secondary. He was more concerned for them to learn, and he learned more patience even with the sheep, who also were very inconsiderate of their shepherd at times. But Moses did not mind. He taught them. Then Moses had to unlearn much, as we read on page 248. Moses had been learning much that he must unlearn. The influences that had surrounded him in Egypt, the love of his foster mother, his own high position as the king's grandson, the dissipation on every hand, the refinement, the subtlety, the mysticism of a false religion, the splendor of idolatrous worship, the solemn grandeur of architecture and sculpture, all had left deep impression upon his developing mind. It had molded, to some extent, his habits and character. That is the same as when we grow up in the city, or in Western society even. It is, we are quite impressed by the accomplishments of men, the jets, the computers, and this and that and the other. And it's difficult to withdraw yourself from these things. And we have to learn that God's power is far superior than these things, that there are more weighty matters in the world than every invention of men. And the Lord teaches us this step by step, and especially through his word and through the Sabbaths that he gives us, where we keep our minds away from all these things and concentrate on the works of nature. Time, change of surroundings, and communion with God could remove these impressions. It would require on the part of Moses himself a struggle, as for life, to renounce error and accept truth. So when you do not find the struggle in your life to renounce error and accept truth, then something must be wrong, really, because it is a struggle. Consider your own lives and think, is it a real struggle to give up error and accept truth? Or is it something that I just say, okay, and that is? Now, if the message that we preach is just an intellectual message, it's not a struggle, really. It may be a little bit a struggle of pride, because if you love a certain theory and cling to it, then to accept another theory, that could be a struggle, yes. But it is not so much. The real struggle begins when our habits are to be changed and our practices are to be changed. That is where the struggle starts, because now to change the life, that is not easy. But God is our helper when the conflict should be too severe for human strength. It even says it's a struggle as for life to renounce error and accept truth. Why is it so hard? Not because the truth itself is complicated or hard. It is because we love sin. We love to go our own way. And we rather would reinterpret the message to fit it to our practices and habits than to change our habits and practices. And it's a struggle for life to really submit to the truth in whatever disguise it comes. That is a struggle as for life. And whoever has experienced this, he is fighting the good fight of faith. Now, there in the wilderness, Moses really unlearned much, but he also learned much. There in the wilderness, he received tremendous revelations. For example, the book of Genesis. About this we read on page 251, as the years rolled on, and he wandered with his flocks in solitary places, pondering upon the oppressed condition of his people, he recounted the dealings of God with his fathers and the promises that were the heritage of the chosen nation, and his prayers for Israel ascended by day and by night. Heavenly angels shed their light around him. Here, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he wrote the book of Genesis. Are you aware of any other book that he wrote there? Yes, the book of Job. This we read in the Bible commentary. Volume 3, page 1140. There we read, the long years amid desert solitudes were not lost. Not only was Moses gaining a preparation for the great work before him, but during this time, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he wrote the book of Genesis and also the book of Job, which would be read with the deepest interest by the people of God under the close of time, especially during the close of time. Now, it is very interesting that Moses received that revelations in particular, Genesis and the book of Job. Why? That was exactly what he needed for the deliverance from Egypt. Does somebody of you have the seven angels with him? The seven angels? Yeah. Well, let's first consider the book of Genesis. Why was this so important that he received that revelation? And as you know probably, A.T. Jones gave a sermon. Oh, it's okay. As you know probably, A.T. Jones gave a sermon on that subject, and he asked his audience, when was Genesis written? Or he told them, I think. It was written in the wilderness when Moses was in Midian. And that was how many years? 1800 years or something? 1500 years after the event had happened, after creation. Why so late? Why after 1500 years? Mm-hmm. Well, the reason was that it was needed at that time. Thank you very much. I want to read you a little bit out of this because it's very interesting. It's in the appendix. That sermon is printed in the appendix of that book, The Seven Angels. And most of you know this very well. But some may not, and so I quickly turn to you to page 325 here. When was Genesis written? Of course, we cannot tell the exact year, but the period. We can know the great thought that was before the world in the time when Genesis was written, the coming out of Egypt. Genesis was written by Moses during the 40 years he was keeping the sheep of his father-in-law, but that was after the message had come to bring the people out of Egypt. The Lord had called Moses to deliver the people, but Moses had not yet learned just how. He made a misstep, the first thing, and had to take 40 years of instruction before this deliverance could be wrought. And in this 40 years he wrote the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis was therefore written at the time of the coming out of Egypt, when God was to deliver his people from Egypt and set them a light in the world for all the world forever. In order to set before you the next particular thought, I shall read again a certain scripture that was read night before last, and I think referred to again last night in the 15th of Exodus, the Song of Moses. Well, then he reads the Song of Moses, and then he talks a little bit about this. And then he asks again the question, why was it written at that time? What was the object of giving Genesis then? It was so that they should become acquainted with creation, the creative power. That is the content of Genesis, isn't it? So that God, by his creative power, might recreate them and bring them into the new world, which he was to create and give to Abraham according to that which he had promised him. Do you see it? So why was Genesis given just then? Because there was a special need just then. The need was creative power. And they learned it in the book of Genesis. Not only that the book of Genesis contained the information about creation, but it actually contained how creation happened, and also, because it was the Word, it was the power of God itself. So whoever would read creation would thereby receive that power which would enable him to be delivered from Egypt, which is delivered from sin. Yeah. The principle is really we must be delivered from Egypt from within before we can be delivered from without. You know this principle, do you? It's spelled out in Christ's Object Lessons. I'm not sure about the page now at the moment. Maybe somebody of you knows. It says, shall not God avenge his own? It must be in that chapter. Yeah, page 174. Christ desires nothing so much as to redeem his heritage from the dominion of Satan, but before we are delivered from Satan's power without, we must be delivered from his power within. 174, 175. So before the Israelites could be delivered from the Egyptian power without, they must be delivered from Egypt within. That is the ways of Egypt, the ways of the sword, which they expected would be the only means. And Moses had to be delivered from this as well, didn't he? For this purpose he received Genesis. And God gave him just what we also need for that last time. We also need to be delivered from the image of the beast within before we can be delivered from the image of the beast without. For this reason, the Lord gives also to us the book of Genesis, teaching us the power of creation, which delivers us from the image of the beast, from the tendency to grab to the sword when it's thick, and to give us this calm trust in the power of God under all circumstances. So that is the power of that is the book of Genesis. Apart from this, we could also say Moses received the story of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and he would see the story in a new light. He would understand more deeply as ever before that God's dealing with his forefathers was not with a sword really, but the sword was only this one incident, and from there on God said, I am your shield, and that from there on Abraham never used the sword. Neither did Isaac and Jacob. So the fact was very clear, the sword was away from them. Another big revelation for Moses, wasn't it? So he received one revelation after another by which God showed him in what way they would be delivered. Now what is special with the book of Job? Why did God... Yes, that's right, the patience of the saints. And that's exactly what we need, isn't it? Here are those who keep the commandments and have the patience of the saints and the faith of Jesus. That is the qualification of God's people who fight against the image of the beast. So for us, the book of Genesis and the book of Job are as well big revelations. And I found a new interest in studying the book of Job. Very, very interesting book. And especially the answer of God in the end to Job is so interesting. You know, we men, we always tend to think that we know, isn't it? The doctors think they know when they examine a person. They know exactly what he has. Often they find out that it isn't so. When we see a problem, we often think that we know exactly what the problem is. But then we find out it isn't so. And so forth. How often does this happen to us? And God asked to Job, have you been there when I created the world? Have you been there when the morning stars sang together? And do you know how the deer gets his child and so forth? And he asked him a lot of questions. And he asked, you're wise, tell me. And in the end, Job had to say, I know nothing really. I know absolutely nothing. What a tremendous knowledge that man gained through that revelation from God. He realized that his wisdom can be in God only. So likewise, we do very wise to not think that we know, but be very careful in our statements and go forward only as the Lord has clearly revealed. In other words, that we live by revelation rather than by our own wisdom. And then you see also the tremendous patience of Job, who waited for a long time and who did not succumb to give up God even in all the troubles he was in. And his friends, they were not making his lot better. They made it much worse. And he did not give up. And the end statement of Job was, and even if he slay me, yet will I trust in him. I will not give up God, even if he slay me. Of course, he did not understand the situation he was in. And he gave expression to this lack of understanding. But after God talked to him, that was cleared away. But he did not give up God. That is the main point under all circumstances. And that taught Moses a very, very important and essential lesson. In Moses' work for God, he was often coming in situations that were incomprehensible. Did I say this correct? In other words, you couldn't see through. Why would Moses be caught in such a situation that he had to run away from the court? Why were his own people charging him that he wanted to kill them while he wanted to save them? Why were they like this? And why could he not continue on the court? All this kind of questions he could have asked, but he was becoming very patient when he looked at Job. He was saying to himself, well, if Job passed that test, I should be able to pass the test too. It's easy for me. At least I'm still healthy and I can keep sheep here in the wilderness and I'm happy here. Job, he lost everything. He lost all his sheep and everything. So Moses must have seen that he was not in a worse situation. Therefore, he received a lot of courage and strength and patience from the book of Job. Likewise, we should. That are the special books for us, the book of Job and the book of Genesis, who fight against the image of the beast, like Moses had to fight against Egypt. And then God gave him the greatest of all revelations, and that was when he appeared to him at the burning bush. Let's read about this in the Bible first, Exodus chapter 3. Mm-hmm. Now, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of those of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am, here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for this place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. So far, so good. Moses must have been very happy to hear this, because that was what was his burden all the time, the deliverance of his people. Moses was free there in the wilderness, but his people, they weren't. They couldn't flee like he could. That would have been impossible physically. So they had to be slaves and do what their taskmasters told them. He was not satisfied that he had his own freedom. He desired the freedom of his people. But when the Lord met him there, he gave him the greatest revelation, even greater than the visions he had received in the book of Genesis and Job. What did he see? A bush burning with fire. Nothing special, or? Very special. There's a great, great lesson that God taught him in that bush, in the very appearance. Now, I think it is safe to say that whenever God gives a revelation, he has a purpose in mind which goes beyond the revelation itself, to illustrate the point. When God comes to a person and speaks to him certain words, the words are very important. But the circumstances in which God speaks the word, the way that he appears to the people or the way that he reveals himself, is a message in itself too. For example, here he came to Joshua one day and gave him the information that he should march around the city 7 times, Jericho and so forth. You know that story. Now, he could have conveyed that information in a dream or through a prophet or in any other way, But no, God appeared, or Christ appeared to Joshua in the form of a man of war, warrior, with a sword and everything, clad in an armor. Now that must have meant something. Why did God do it this way? Why didn't he appear to him in a burning bush, like to Moses, or as an angel, simply, or in a dream, or something like this? Why did he appear to him like this? Because he wanted to tell him a message, apart from that he should march around seven times, and that was that he is the captain of the Lord's host, that he carries the sword. That was the big lesson to be taught. Likewise, when Christ healed the people, he said sometimes very few words only, but the healing itself was a message, wasn't it? To show them, I am the God that gives you a new heart. Or when Jesus appeared as a humble man on this earth, he did not only appear to convey some words. He could have done this in another way. No, he appeared also to give a special message in the fact that he came as a man. He wanted to show the mystery that God comes into human flesh. He wanted to reveal that. And so we could go on and on and on. You see, God always wants to give a message that goes beyond the words that he's conveying. And the message is also in the way that he reveals himself. So likewise here, the fact that God revealed himself in a burning bush was a message itself. God is not, how shall I say, a person that just makes action, something new each day, for no purpose. That is what you find in the world, isn't it? There, the shop owner, one time he offers his goods on a round table, another time on a corner table, sometimes on a table where light is shining on. Well, they have a purpose too, haven't they? They want to show the people here, look, our goods are good, buy them. But the purpose of God are much deeper purposes. They contain a very deep message. So what was the message of the burning bush? Now, first of all, we see that Moses saw a bush burning and it was not consumed. Now, to see a burning bush in the wilderness might not be too unusual, even though it was unusual. You don't see every day a burning bush. So when you see a burning bush, it naturally catches your attention. It's light and so forth. And then he looked closer and he saw that it burned and burned and burned. It was not consumed. And that was something he had never seen before. Now, there are some people, I just want to mention this, by the way, who claim that in the wilderness that there are bushes who spread out methane that burns on top of them, and that this was this kind. But I don't believe in that story, to be honest, because that was evidently a singular act of God. It was not some natural thing that has been always there. I cannot even prove that this is true, that there are bushes that spread out methane that burned at some time. I would doubt even that. But especially that it was not that the case back there. It was a miracle. Yeah. Okay, so very clear. There was a miracle of God. I think there's no question about this. And let's see this point very clearly, that God used a shrub to illustrate an important lesson. Now, he could have used something else. He could have used a cedar, if it was there in the wilderness. But he could have led him to a place where there were cedars. He could have used a mighty rock that burned. But no, he used a shrub. And a shrub is, you could say, the lowliest of all plants, isn't it? Like the grass. It's nothing special. There would not be grass in the wilderness. It was too dry, probably. But there were shrubs. And that were the most common, most ordinary things there. And this he chose to reveal his presence. Now the presence of God was in the fire, but the shrub he used to be there. Now isn't it a miracle how God can present himself in a shrub? How he can be contained in a shrub at all? Furthermore, God used the shrub to dwell himself in there, and the shrub was not consumed. That is a great miracle. Now the shrub symbolizes the human nature into which Christ came. And here was divinity dwelling in humanity, and humanity was not consumed. Miracle of all miracles. How can this happen? Pardon? That's right. That's right. That is the greatest mystery ever given to men, revealed to men, the mystery of godliness. And this mystery is repeated in every born-again child of God. And that is something that Moses received there in the wilderness, that revelation. Sister White is writing quite a bit about this. In our next study, we will read this very carefully, step by step. It's in the first chapter of Desire of Ages. I just want to read a few statements from here as a preview for our next study. Page 23. The burning bush in which Christ appeared to Moses revealed God. The symbol chosen for the representation of deity was a lowly shrub that seemingly had no attractions. This enshrined the infinite. The all-merciful God shrouded his glory in a most humble type that Moses could look upon it and live. So in the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, God communicated with Israel, revealing to men his will and imparting to them his grace. God's glory was subdued and his majesty veiled, that the weak vision of finite men might behold it. So Christ was to come in the body of our humiliation, in the likeness of men. In the eyes of the world he possessed no beauty that he should desire him. Yet he was the incarnate God, the light of heaven and earth. His glory was veiled, his greatness and majesty were hidden, that he might draw near to sorrowful, tempted men. What a revelation was given to Moses, one of the greatest revelations. And in this, God revealed how he would come to this earth one day and how he wanted to dwell in his people. It's interesting, but Jesus also caught the attention of the people, didn't he? He was a lowly shrub, but they all saw him and they looked closer. But very few recognized the great message that God conveyed to them in Jesus. So likewise, very few have understood what message God conveyed to Moses in the lowly shrub. But about this we will study more in our next session, as the time is now over.